my talk today is very simple. Higgs is a slepton, and in fact, the idea of Higgs as a slepton is an old idea. It's been around for a while. It's basically been around since the early days of supersymmetry, except that for a long time it's basically been common to believe that you cannot make this idea work. And the purpose of this talk will be to point out that this might not quite be so. So before actually I move on to any details, I would like to start with some motivation for considering Higgs as a slepton. And then I will describe a framework in which this idea could possibly be embedded. Then I'll discuss a simple model, which just for fun, I call TSSM4. Now, TSSM4, we TV scale supersymmetric standard model with four generations. I don't know if that makes much sense, but as I said, that's just for fun, and that's why I got quote unquote there. And TSSM4 will be a, you know, sort of concrete realization of this idea of Higgs as a slepton. I'll discuss some signatures for the, actually for present collider experiments that will be, that should be testable as far as this scenario is concerned. And at the end of my talk, if I have time, which I hope will, I'll try to address some other issues related to this whole framework. Now, this work was done with Aaron Grant, who's a postdoc at Harvard. Actually, you know, I noticed that, you know, my name said Harvard. Next to it, it said Harvard as far as my affiliation is concerned, but on the announcement of the seminar. Actually, I'm not from Harvard, not anymore. I'm at Stony Brook now. And when I was at Harvard, people thought that I was at Cornell. When I was at Cornell, people had no idea who I was. So, you know, it's really relevant. And so, we did this work while I was still at Harvard. And then I wrote a follow-up paper which basically dealt with these other issues. So, what is the motivation for thinking about Higgs slepton? Well, the electroweak symmetry is believed to be broken by the Higgs mechanism. We haven't seen the Higgs yet, but it's commonly believed that it's broken via the Higgs mechanism. And in a non-supersymmetric standard model, all you have to do is add a single complex scalar field with the appropriate quantum numbers so that you can break the electroweak symmetry down to the you want electromagnetic. In a SUSY context, you can't. I'm sorry?
I mean, you're talking about physical field or physical field?
In your terminology, I'm physical field. So, in the supersymmetric context, however, one has to watch out for gauge anomalies. In particular, you cannot just introduce one chiral superfield that contains that unphysical complex scalar, because the corresponding fermion will also be charged with the same quantum numbers, and that will introduce gauge anomalies. So you have to watch out for these gauge anomalies, and actually, if you are careful about things, then in the context of the standard model, or in the context of the standard model gauge group, there are basically two logical possibilities. In fact, there are only two logical possibilities if you don't want to add any exotic type of representations as far as the matter is concerned. And these two possibilities are either you add vector-like pairs, such as H plus, H minus, some people call it H up, H down, some reason I use H plus, H minus. And if you add a single vector-like pair like this, this is just MSSM, and that has been studied to, it has been basically studied to this. However, you have another possibility how to cancel anomalies. You don't have to introduce vector-like pairs, but you can rather introduce complete generations. If you add a complete SU5 generation, then anomaly is canceled. And these are the only two solutions to the anomaly cancellation conditions as far as adding extra matter, as long as you don't want to add exotic representations. And usually you don't want to add exotic representations because typically some chunk of those remain massless after the electroweak breaking, and we don't see any massless states around, so we don't want that. So, naturally, you can try to think of Higgs as a slipton, and this stems from the fact that the Higgs quantum numbers, electroweak quantum numbers, are the same as of electroweak doublet lepton, L. So I consider a complete generation, and these just denote the chiral superfield. So I use notations that are slightly different from the conventional ones here. So Q is the left-handed up fork, the doublet one. These are the left-handed anti-forks, and this is the electroweak doublet lepton L, and this is the single. So,
excuse me, in the early days of supersymmetry, when people thought of Higgs as a slipton,
right,
they of course kept in mind that maybe they can use this lepton, which is a partner for the known lepton, not for the fourth generation lepton.
That's right.
And this, I think, is ruled out.
That, well, actually, I'm gonna point that out. But as far as the quantum numbers are concerned, the quantum numbers of H minus of the standard model are the same as that of L. So you can try to, you can attempt to identify Higgs as a lepton. Now, there are, however, two problems, and one problem was anticipated here a couple of transparencies before I'm going to get to it, but there is another problem which one has to watch out for, and that is a problem, because in the standard paradigm where your fundamental scale by which you cut off all the higher dimensional operators is of order 10 to the 19 GeV of order of the Planck scale. I mean, I'm being loose here. You might want to take the gut scale or the string scale there, whatever you want. You are going to have a problem with generating upward Yukawa couplings if you identify the Higgs with this lepton in the context of supersymmetry. The reason why is because in order to get an upward Yukawa coupling, just the gauge quantum number, just the gauge quantum numbers tell you they would have to write down a coupling like this, QUL star, where for Q you would pull out a fermion, for U you pull out a fermion, and from here you have to pull out a scalar. But this coupling is not holomorphic. It cannot come from a superpotential. And you could generate such couplings once supersymmetry is broken, non-holomorphic couplings like that. However, those would be suppressed by M Suzy squared over M Planck squared if they come from higher dimensional operators. And that's the order of 10 to the minus 32, which is too small to explain the Yukawa couplings in the real world. Now, this can be actually avoided in the context of recently proposed, or maybe not so recently anymore, but TV scale quantum gravity, where the fundamental Planck scale is actually of order TeV. And the largeness of the four-dimensional Planck scale is explained by the fact that you have a bunch of extra dimensions whose volume is much larger than the inverse of TeV. So by the higher dimensions law, then the four-dimensional Planck scale comes out to be large. However, now, since we have the fundamental Planck scale, which is presumably the scale by which we cut off all the higher dimensional operators, we can identify, we can make this idea of Higgs as a slipton work, at least in this context, that we can generate the desirable up-quark Yukawa coupling. And the way we're going to do this, I mean, one way to do this, imagine that you have a Spurian superfield X, whose it's a singlet superfield standard model gauge group, and its F term breaks supersymmetry. Okay, so the F term of this guy is going to be of order of M Planck fundamental squared, which is TeV squared. Then desirable Yukawa couplings I can generate from higher dimensional terms in the Kähler potential. And the term that I'm going to write down is going to be X star, L star, QU. I'm going to pull out F from here, a fermionic component. I mean, I'm going to pull out fermionic component from here, scalar from here, and the F term from here. And if you just add up the thetas and theta bars and then integrate over d theta squared, d theta bar squared, you will see that everything works out, and then you get a Yukawa coupling like this. Yeah. It breaks the F term. It's the F term. The F term is non-zero. No, the F term is non-zero. I mean, how that happens, I don't care. It's some superfield whose F term is non-zero, therefore supersymmetry is broken. Well, I mean, I don't know why not, but I mean, I just turned on an F term of some superfield.
Okay.
Yeah, the F term. I've never said anything about the lowest component of F.
No.
So.
But in some cases,
No. But wait a second. I mean, I'm talking about up quarks in general. I'm not talking about U quark. I mean, I have to generate similar coupling for the top quark, which is not zero. So I have to, you know, so for all three generations that I have.
Well, in this sense, you are getting something different, because usually what people say, they say, okay, there are supersymmetric masses in the superfield, okay, so top and stop have some supersymmetric common mass, and then there is a supersymmetry breaking the split term. One goes down, one goes up.
Right.
What you are saying, you're saying that there is no common supersymmetric mass for the upfield whatsoever, and the entire mass, the fermion gets is due to supersymmetry breaking.
Well, no, because if the vev of L was zero, then the mass would be zero. So no, let's not get confused.
Let's say there is no. Let's put it that.
Oh, but then you want to.
No supersymmetry breaking. Then X does not develop.
Yeah.
Then there is no mass term.
That's right. Exactly.
So in this sense, the mass is entirely due to supersymmetry.
Well, if you assume that the vev of L is also driven by radiated correction.
It's another necessary condition.
Sure.
But in principle,
exactly.
If there is no supersymmetry breaking,
that's
term
right.
whatsoever.
That's right.
By the way, what about stop?
Okay, hold on a second. Let me point out one thing. You see, this the reason why this might seem confusing is because, you know, you're generating these non-supersymmetric couplings here, right? And they're of order one. And how is this possible? Well, the simple observation is that you have broken supersymmetry, say, softly, but almost completely. Because your supersymmetry breaking scale is almost the same as your fundamental scale in the theory. Okay. So, well, as far as the stop is concerned,
there's no supersymmetry below
the supersymmetry is really badly broken, but it could still be, softly broken. Softly, but badly.
But for example, why are there even any scalars below the scale?
Well, that you will have to sit down and work out what the masses of those scalars would be. So you will have to work out what the soft masses are. Now, the soft masses might be surprised by, depend upon the particular scenario you're talking about. The soft masses would be, which would answer your question, I guess, they would be suppressed in certain cases by the gauge coupling. Okay, so you generate them at one loop. So you don't break, the soft masses are zero at what will get a mass?
Things couple through this coupling here, since it breaks supersymmetry as badly as possible, because the top you call is more than one. Those would all get pulled up to the high scale length.
You mean via loops?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they're still suppressed by coupling. But you see, this is a word of TV. So, you know, you can still have some softness at 300 GeV, because they're suppressed by, say, gauge coupling.
The mass term just by head, in addition to this.
Yeah, so
which mass term?
Quarks.
No. Quarks are massless before I break supersymmetry.
Okay, when you break supersymmetry, where is the mass term for this quartz? I don't think so.
No, not from here. I'm not breaking, I'm not generating it at the tree level. I'm saying at one loop you will generate them, right?
But then they will be genetically lighter than quarks, right?
Why?
Because the quarks are at
three level
and
because you see, I mean, no,
the
no, of course not.
Quarks are at one loop level.
No. Wait a second. What do you? The
quark. I don't understand. I mean,
he just hasn't written the soft term for the
other. I haven't.
Maybe we should see it.
No. Wait a second. No, this is an important point. I don't want to let it slip.
No, I just don't understand. Okay, I see that this transistor generates the top quark mass. I do see it.
No. Hold on.
How it generates the top quark mass?
Hold on a second. You are forgetting, I think, that there is an L star here. Okay, this is a VEV of the Higgs. This is the same as VEV of the Higgs. Okay, which is m electro weak, which is much lower than, well, not much lower, but say an order of magnitude lower than TeV. Okay, so you have to watch out for this. So from here, I'm gonna get quark mass, which is top quark mass, which is 174 GeV. Okay, that doesn't mean that the quark mass has to be 30 GeV. No, it can be 300 GeV because it has nothing to do with this coupling. It comes from loops, okay? You know, guy goes in, stuff circles around, guy goes out.
So you know the atom multiplied by TeV, right?
Okay, this is no different. Okay, consider your favorite supersymmetry breaking scenario. Say, gauge mediated, okay? In the gauge mediated scenario, the stop mass, okay, has nothing to do with these couplings. It comes from loops, and it will be, I don't know, 300 GeV, okay? Within the exact same scenario, if I can construct this Spurion superfield S, whose valve breaks supersymmetry from some nasty combinations it has to be gauge invariant couplings. Suppose I construct that in your favorite gauge-mediated scenario. Then I'm saying, in a TeV case, this coupling is suppressed by only 1 over M Planck fundamental squared. So once this guy is of order TeV squared, M Planck fundamental squared, the corresponding Yukawa coupling will be of order 1. This has nothing to do with the stop, okay? The stop comes from the loops. So there is, you know.
But you say, let's say you switch off the top. Okay, no. What are matters of top quark and stop quark? Let's say that this term is not there.
Oh, if this term is not there, then zero. No, hold on a second. If you don't break supersymmetry, then everything is zero, right?
Everything is zero, right?
The supersymmetry breaking comes from f of x being non-zero.
I don't know, I miss a point, or maybe other people understand that I'm explaining. I don't understand why there is such a drastic difference in generation of the mass of top and stop. You say that there are two absolutely different mechanisms that have to work in the case of top and stop.
Let me answer this in a slightly different way. Let me answer this in a slightly different way. If L, suppose I break, but L never develops the vacuum expectation value.
Okay.
The lowest component of L, superfield,
okay,
never develops. So
okay,
the electroweak symmetry is not broken.
Okay.
Then this term is not going to generate the top quark mass.
And so?
A stop still can be, because we've broken supersymmetry, stop, of course, will pick up a mass for loops. Of course.
Why top won't pick up?
Because you have to break chiral, because top is a fermion. It has chiral quantum numbers.
But from the real world quantum numbers, top and stop are indistinguishable.
No, but supersymmetry is broken.
If
L is zero, supersymmetry can still be broken because f of x is zero.
Supersymmetry is broken, but electroweak symmetry is not broken. Therefore,
sure.
How can you write?
Of course you can write, because it's scale. It's phi phi star. That's what.
Yeah, you can write phi phi star for supersymmetry.
And that's what I said. Phi goes in, phi comes out, or phi goes in, phi starts goes in.
Okay.
Because it's chiral versus scalar.
Okay.
That's right. So the upshot is that in this TeV business, I mean, it doesn't have to be TeV. I'm just bringing up TeV because it's easy to talk about it, okay? Technically speaking, you could cook up a model where you could generate terms like this without TeV. But let me just stick with this. In the TeV scale quantum gravity scenario, I can actually generate upward Yukawas in this kind of fashion, or fashion you like. I mean, this is only one way to do it. But the bottom line is the upward Yukawas will come from higher dimensional operators in the Kähler potential, which is not holomorphic. Holomorphically, you cannot do it. From superposition, you cannot do it. But from Kähler potential, you can do it. And since M Planck fundamental, or the cutoff scale for these higher dimensional operators, is of order of the Suzy breaking scale, or, you know, in that range, you don't get extra suppression for the upward Yukawa. Okay. So now, here's the TSSM4 transparency. The question that one would like to ask is the one that you brought up in the very beginning of my talk, which is, can the Higgs be identified with the superpartner of a known lepton within the three generations? No. And you already answered that question, which is that the answer is not without fine-tuning. If you fine-tune, you can do whatever you want, of course. We know that. The experience has taught us that if you fine-tune, you can achieve anything you want. But without fine-tuning, you can't. And the reason why is actually very simple. The reason why is because of the problem that you will get with the neutrino masses if you try to do that. How does that work? Well, you have a coupling between, this is, we're talking about the supersymmetric context, so we have Gay-Genos. And so you have a coupling which reads the Gay-Geno, L and L star, from which I can pull a fermionic component here, and a scalar component here. And if L star acquires the BEV, because that's what we're trying to do, try to identify the Higgs with the lepton lowest component of the lepton superfield, then you're going to have a mixing between gay genos and the leptons. So you have charged leptons mixing with the charged gay genos, which actually is not such a big deal, turns out. But phenomenologically, you would have to worry about it, because tau, you know, tau lepton would mix with the charged genos, and then you have to worry about electroweak universality. It turns out that if you sit down and do it carefully, the bounds are not that tough. You can actually push that through. But the problem is that the problem is the mixing with the neutral gay genos, in particular with the Bino and the Wino, or more precisely a linear combination of that with the corresponding neutrino from here. And so you have a CISO type of mass generation for the neutrino sitting in that supermultiplet, which is that you have the Gay-Geno mass, and this is the Gay-Geno and this is the neutrino. You have the Gay-Geno mass here, the neutrino entry here, diagonal one is zero, but then you have a mixing of order G times V, where V is the bev of the of L star and G is the electroweak coupling. And if you diagonalize this matrix, then you get that the neutrino picks up a mass of order m electroweak squared divided by m lambda, which I'm going to roughly call m Suzy. And if you don't want the Gay-Geno masses to be too much higher than TV, if you want them to be of order TV or lower, then you get a lower bound on the neutrino mass, which is 10 GeV. That's way, way moved out. So bottom line is that if we try to do this with three generations and identify the electroweak Higgs with the, say, with the superpartner of tau neutrino, then tau neutrino would be over 10 GeV or so, unless I want to push supersymmetry breaking scale much higher than TV, and that's what I meant by fine-tuning. And if you want to fine-tune your natural, if you want to sort of wash down the whole business with naturalness and hierarchy and all that, then you could push the supersymmetry breaking scale a little bit up, but then you would run into the problem that, well, with that you would have to, of course, push the fundamental Planck scale as well. And then you can fine-tune it and you can get the neutrinos to be light, but then you're paying the price of pushing supersymmetry breaking scale to 1,000 or 10,000 TeV, and let me not do that scale. But what you could do is you can add the fourth generation and declare the Higgs declare L4 as the Higgs supersymmetry. Okay. Now, yesterday somebody asked me, why is this any better than MSSM? Well, it's neither better nor worse. It's just that it's different. In the MSSM case, you have H plus and H minus. In this case, you have only the analog of H minus. And the phenomenology is different. In fact, I'll come to the point where this difference comes. Phenomenology is different, and the signatures are different. It's neither better nor worse. It's just there's one logical possibility with H plus and H minus, and that comes from anomaly cancellation requirement. And then there's another possibility, which is a full generation, which is another solution to anomaly cancellation condition. So MSSM has been explored. Let me explore this.
It's going to be a dumb question, but how do you need a voltage to give me asked about up and down in
our system? Next transform. The fourth generation neutrino will pick up that seesaw mass. In fact, we'll see in a second how when people add the fourth generation, right? Usually, you have to worry about the neutrino because neutrino cannot be lighter than 45 GeV. Well, actually, it's not such a big deal because you can always write down Dirac term for the neutrino. You know, just introduce a right-handed neutrino, write down a Dirac term, and you can make it as heavy as you want. So it's not really a big deal. However, in this case, you can generate the mass via this QCSO type of mechanism, and so the fourth generation neutrino automatically becomes heavy, but you have to make sure that it's heavier than 45 GeV. So if you assume that the major contribution to the neutrino mass is coming from that will give you an additional constraint, and that we will explore in a second.
See, the seesaw mass comes from the Gino coupling.
The neutral gauge Gino basically plays the role of the right-handed neutrino, fourth generation right-handed neutrino.
Now, you've broken supersymmetry as much as you possibly could, so in principle, you could just make that coupling smaller.
No, because that comes from the gauge invariant. That coupling is...
No, there's, in other words, there's an effective operator you can write that actually has two F-couplings in it that could mitigate coupling from the gauge.
You mean I can fine-tune it, that's what you mean,
yeah,
in principle. That's right.
You have to tune it to be small.
That's right. Yes, you can write down the higher dimensional operator so that you can fine-tune it and you can make it small, and then you could make it work even with three generations. But one way or another, it's still fine-tuned. So... I'm just avoiding fine-tuning because I think you would be terribly bored if I started doing fine-tuning on the blackboard right now. So you colors. So we have this TSSM4 model, which is nothing but a four-generation model with the Higgs identified with the fourth-generation lepton superfield, and the up quarks are going to be generated from these terms in the Taylor potential, just like I said before. The down quarks I can generate either from the super potential, or I can write down fancier terms in the Taylor potential. And depending upon your flavor symmetries or whatnot, super potential might not contribute at all. You might kill the super potential terms because you might write down some flavor indices to this field. And then, the naive question, why is this term bigger than this term would not arise, but it actually doesn't even have to arise in the first place because everything is of order 1. Now, of course, when you say everything is of order 1, that sounds a little weird because you expect some hierarchy somewhere here. So then you say, oh, wait a second, but then these masses would be bigger than these masses, but that doesn't have to be the case because I can kill these terms altogether and just write down Taylor potential terms which will generate similar Taylor potential terms which will generate the color couplings for the down quark. Now, for the charged leptons, it's the same business. For the first three generation where A and B run from 1 to 3, I can use super potential or corresponding Taylor potential terms. Now, there's a little scare here going on immediately because you will realize if you write this down, L4, E4, L4, that this vanishes because of the anti-symmetry of SU2 contractions, and therefore that term in the superpotential cannot give you correct Yukawa couplings for the fourth generation charged lepton. That would be bad because these guys had better be really heavy, at least 185 or something like GeV. But, of course, we're working in a context of TV scale quantum gravity where everything is possible. And you just have to sit down and write down a long enough term in the Taylor potential, including covariant superderivatives, and then if you expand it, do the integration over theta squared, theta bar squared carefully, which is not that difficult, you will discover that this term will be a coupling like this, except that this is going to be a fermion scalar. So,
when you get this, you know,
yeah.
In both of the models, yes, when you got it, look like the sequential approximation, because you see what I explained to that.
Mixing?
Radiation correction to rho. Because
what?
The standard argument
to rho.
Ratio of masses of the body. It is the place where you have the most stringent constraint for heavy particles. And if you say that you have, heavy masses, say, of portion ratio, it could produce large correction to this parameter rho.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question in the present form, but let me rephrase it. And then if I'm rephrasing it correctly, then you can let me know. Typically, when people don't like adding the fourth generation in the context of minimal supersymmetric standard model, they worry about the precision electroweak data as far as the radiative corrections are concerned. Now, say, the S parameter, okay? Some people even make a claim that if you add the fourth generation, the S parameter rules out the fourth generation because it's very marginal, blah, 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 blah. Now, in the MSSM context, that might or might not be the case. I'm not going to argue that. But in the TV quantum gravity case, this is irrelevant. And let me point out why, okay? Actually, the people who pointed that out were Kolbe and Hall, I think. See, in a TV scale quantum gravity case, you have not just the MSSM with its dimension 4 coupling, but you have all these higher dimensional operators which you have absolutely no idea about what they are. Okay, so the fourth generation shifts the S parameter this way. I add some generic coupling, higher dimensional coupling, which I have to take into account, which will shift it back. So I have absolutely no idea why it should do that. Of course it's not a predictive pattern. I mean, there are certain things that are predictive, and there are certain things that you have no control over because you don't have a concrete model. So here, when I say TSSM4, I mean this massless spectrum, this kind of content. There's a bunch of higher dimensional operators I have no control over. I'm not going to discuss their predictive power because I can't. What I'm going to discuss is from the massless spectrum, I'm going to show you there is a prediction you are going to make, which is testable at left, okay? And that's the only thing that I'm going to focus on.
But this iteration I'm talking about actually goes otherwise, because this iteration correction we are related with row correction are operators of less dimension, right? Because if I was putting an iterator form in something like kinetic, in the standard model for terminology, do this something like covariant derivative of this
I understand, but I understand what you're saying. But isn't it evident that if I take the mass of the fourth generation to infinity, that it should decouple?
No.
What do you mean?
It's not at all. That's what I'm trying to say. Exactly the case.
There is no decoupling for
certain.
But okay. I mean, wait a second. No. Come on. I mean, I can add the vector-like generation. I can decouple. You agree on that, right? I can take a vector-like generation, chiral plus anti-chiral, and decouple it. You agree with that? No, I'm not going to pay any price because I'm going to say that the effect
of higher-dimensional generation is not decoupled.
But that's right. That nothing decouples in it. That's right.
It's not decoupled. So in this way, it seems evident that it's
decoupled,
but it's not.
No, hold on a second. Let me make the statement once again. If I took a vector-like generation, then I could decouple it. Okay?
Not by a higher scale, because
Okay, then let me rephrase it. I can invent a higher dimensional operator that will kill that contribution, just like in the S parameter.
Okay, you can just
start playing,
but I'm exactly disagreeing with that.
That is not evident to me why that's not possible, but...
The things that don't get a mass from electroweak symmetry breaking can't in the decoupling limit cannot affect electroweak
decision. Right, but imagine that you have this
mass. Well, that's what I just said.
Let's say that this mass is like below CEV, where you have quantum gravity and all the stuff.
But it's still much higher than
electroweak.
Higher
than electroweak, then say 200.
That's right,
okay.
Yeah.
So then there is an age where you can interpret this as a non-legated correction. Put in one CEV as the upper limit.
So I wouldn't go. Okay.
I'm saying that then you have much higher dimensional effect of the operator. You have a rate of less dimension.
The mass term type of operator?
Oh, no, I said this one. Give you pi modulus square divided by pi delta pi. It's less dimension.
Oh, so it's non-polynomial.
It's not a polynomial, and it is the one which is produced by a radiative correction.
Oh, come on, but then I can extend it and I can always match it. I mean, what do you
think? Extend in what sense? Pi is your cube, which has vacuum average and normally
it's not zero. It's not zero because L has a vacuum expectation. So I can extend it. I mean,
okay.
And then I can match it with higher than.
No,
come on. I mean, like, as I said, if I took
a
vector...
The loop, you have singular, you have something, the loop is being cut off from below, it's a mass of something which is proportional to pi by itself. Yeah. Therefore, you get pi in the denominator.
Yeah.
And that's the specific feature of electroweak correction. They look as, it looks as if they defy the decoupling theorem of a consistent correlation.
But...
So you tend pi bigger, you make the heavier, you make the mass heavier. Seemingly
okay.
You want to decouple, you make the correction larger.
I understand.
But he's making it heavier with things that don't break electromagnetic.
There we go. There we go. I said that in different
but
physical language, but.
What's your discussion correction?
No,
what
if
you make maybe after it's divided.
No, okay. I said this already. Okay, if I took a vector-like generation. Come on, we have to be able to decouple it, okay?
No, I got it. If you add the vector-like generation with the mass, not
that's what I'm saying, vector-like. Vector-like, non-chiral supersymmetry, hypermultiple. If you add the hypermultiple, I should be able to decouple it, okay? There's no way. I mean, no, but I can always mimic the effect. You see, if I take a vector-like generation, I can always decouple. I can always mimic the effect of that. Okay, with higher dimensional operators. Come on, I mean, okay. If what I'm saying right now, if the naive physical picture of what I'm saying right now is not correct, then I don't know. Then we're in a big trouble with MSSM. Then I mean, like.
No,
we're
not. But that's a known fact. That if you take an MSSM, you take say the top and top carrier. You think that you proceed in the direction of decoupling, right? Because you make something heavier. But their contribution in the WZ boson mass splitting grows enormously. And that's because whenever you make something heavier, while it is expectation value, there is no decoupling.
That's right.
In the ordinary sense of.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm not doing that, okay? I mean,
he has four generations with the mass of the particles is generated.
What?
No,
the anti-generation of what?
Just like the three, they're sequential. It's
I thought you had a generation and an anti-generation.
No.
The fourth one, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't have to. I mean, if you want to add the anti-generation,
well,
sure.
Their comment, you do have.
No. Wait a second. I don't. I don't have to. No. I mean, because what you're saying basically would mean that the fourth generation is completely ruled out. Even in the MSSM.
In a sense, it's
not. Well, it's not. In a sense, it's not because you're.
No, this is a chiral generation. If it's a chiral generation, there are extremely stringent limits of the fourth generation. If it is just sequential, like the three previous, and you still want to keep the W.
No, because the point
it's virtually impossible to squeeze.
The point that you are making has I mean, it's even stronger than the one with the S parameter, right? I mean, the S parameter argument is nothing compared with what you're saying then. And then it should be completely ruled out and should be evident to everybody.
No, it's the literature, not my discovery or not my friend. If you look in the literature, people who play with four sequential generations, they say that it's not possible to split the four generation in the standard complex because of the relative product.
That's right, but what I'm saying is that higher dimensional operators, presumably, at least a priori, before you make the statement that it's impossible, I'm saying that one should sit down and see whether higher dimensional operators can. You see, you are saying that it's impossible without writing them down.
The dimensional operator is responsible for that. The left dimensional operator.
Can I mimic the well, what do you mean no? I mean, I don't know. If it's obvious to you, then okay. Then I close my book. But it's not obvious to you. Is it obvious to everybody? Okay. It's not obvious to me that you cannot mimic these guys with higher dimensional operators. You might be right, I don't know, okay? But a priori, I mean, unless my intuition is failing me really badly, I don't see, it's not evidence to me why you cannot do that, okay? If you can show that would be great, you would rule out this model and all the other four generation models, that would be just great. Yes. Please. Yes.
I've not gotten, I'm presumably not supposed to write down such a term with L1, 2, 3. Is that right?
Well, that depends. You might want to write it down, but that also depends upon what kind of, flavor symmetries you have. Yeah. Coming to that, good. Okay, think about it this way. If the first three and the fourth generations are completely decoupled, you wouldn't have that problem that you just pointed out, right?
Well, if you're going to go ahead and write that term and get it down.
Okay.
Because you needed it for the fourth
generation. No, for the fourth generation, but if I start writing down L3 type of thing.
I write L3.
And so what?
And I would do the same thing
for
the third generation.
No. I mean, one of the L4s has to get it there. And L1, L2, L3 does not get there. But let me rephrase that, okay? You do have to, because actually these terms already break R parity, right? In the fourth generation sector. Now you do have to worry about possible reflections on the first three generations. But that's actually really easy to take care of. And if zeroth approximation, imagine that the first three and the fourth generation don't mix at all. Then you're all set. Now, I'm going to show you in the next transparency how to do that without any fine-tuning. So, another thing in this context, coming back to this discussion, is that the Leibhigs is no longer a prediction of supersymmetry, which actually might not be such a bad thing because we haven't seen one yet. Because the Higgs mass actually comes from the Kähler potential. And if you look at the scalar potential, it's no different. If you look at the corresponding contribution to the scalar potential, it's no different than the one that you would have in non-supersymmetric standard model context. So this can tolerate any Higgs mass you want a priori. And once again, let me emphasize why is this not so bizarre? Because you have broken supersymmetry softly, but almost completely. Okay, so that's the key. So now, since you've done this, then you could say, wait a second, why do I need all these super partners? This is not predictive at all, because I'm basically talking about a non-supersymmetric standard model, at least below some scale, okay? And do I have any predictive power here? Do I have a signature that I can grab onto? And the answer is, I've lost track of time with these discussions. So I got 10 more minutes? Okay, good. You see, this is the transparency before the last one. So far, if you've been counting, it's been five. This is the sixth one. The last one is going to be the seventh one. How can you make a one-hour talk out of seven transparencies? I have no idea. You just have to come to ITP and then, you know. That's right. There's a lot of help coming from the audience. So, is this scenario predictive? And I'm going to say that, in a sense, it is. So how is it predicted? So let me require that the fourth generation, we've already had this discussion half hour ago, the fourth generation mass is bigger than 45 GeV so that I don't have a problem with the Z decay data. And it basically gives you an upper back. Well, no, if I assume that this mass predominantly comes from that Fiso matrix that I wrote down, then that would give you, say, an upper bound on the gauge genome masses. So if you didn't have this freedom of adding the fourth generation right-handed neutrino and writing down like a crazy mass by hand, then you'd have an upper bound on the gauge genome mass. That's one. Then, in fact, there's even an upper bound on this guy, assuming that the gauge genomes are not too heavy. Because you remember, it was like a 3x3 matrix. I wrote it as a 2x2 matrix. That's really a 3x3 matrix. If you tilt away with the parameters, then you discover that if the gauge genome masses are not bigger than TV, then mu4 is about 65 GeV or less. And so also in this scenario, you have three neutralinos, and for a large part of the parameter space, two are typically light, at least one is light, relatively light, well, depends on which for light. But so if you take a sample point, say the M1, the capital M's are the...
So this 65, that's the Fiso mass, it's the things that are the TEV.
Yeah.
I think this is already ruled out. This is a normal neutrino with normal quantum.
We computed the... No, it's not a... Well, it's the fourth generation neutrino.
But it's an electroweak doublet. It's a member of an electroweak doublet.
That's right. We computed the cross sections, and you have to be careful. No, hold on. If it has it been ruled out by lab 2?
Yes.
Oh, it has? Yes. Okay, then the data just came out or something?
No.
Well, when did it come out? Last that I looked up the data, which was when we wrote the paper. When was the data?
So the experiment that you looked just for...
No, but actually, no. Why don't you be careful? I'm going to make the qualification because it depends upon what kind of decays you have, okay? And depend upon what kind of decays you have, it might or might not be ruled out. You might know the data better than me at the moment, but...
Even if it doesn't decay, you pair produce them. So you can't see that, but you can tag things that you produce...
Like bees, for example.
...with initial state radiation.
Okay, well, let me mention what I'm talking about. Okay, let me point out what I'm talking about, and then if that's not satisfactory, then it might be ruled out. That would be great, you know? Because last summer, when we were writing the paper, when we checked the data, when we did the computation of the cross sections, it wasn't ruled out. So the lab 2 data was not up yet. Okay. So, so let me take a simple point to illustrate what I'm talking about. And capital M's are the gauge genome masses. And the M4 is, say, 185 GeV for the charge, fourth generation charge lepton mass. Then you get these charge genome masses. And you get the neutralino masses, say 56 GeV, 57 GeV, and the third one will be 156 GeV. This would be predominantly neutralino corresponding to the U1. This would be corresponding to the fourth, predominantly to the fourth generation neutrino. And this will be the SU2 neutralino, predominantly. So if you compute the neutralino production cross section, okay? The cross section is 0.31 picobars. Now, the experimental bound that I know was 0.6 picobars for the neutralino production cross section if the neutralinos at the end of the day predominantly decay through bees. They can, in principle, decay through the lepton. But, in fact, that's ruled out. That is ruled out. So, you could have, that bound was 0.02, okay? And that's the bound that I know. That's ruled out if they predominantly decay through charged leptons. However, this you can avoid, and I'm going to show you how to avoid this. So, if the neutralinos don't decay, if they decay only through the quarks, okay, then at least from these numbers that I've written down, unless you have better numbers than I do, then it's not ruled out yet. It's really close, marginal.
If they don't decay, it's about 80 GeV.
You mean even if they don't decay at all?
Yes.
And why would that be ruled out?
So you can bound things that are completely invisible by using initial state radiation.
Right.
So you look for an excess in the single photon for kinetic energy.
And when was this analysis done?
I had...
because this new data for LEP2 that would rule this out or rule this in or whatever, it hasn't come out yet, so... The cross-section data is not as good. I mean, this is the last I know, the 0.6 picobars for
well, I had Delphi given some analysis about the media, but I think there's at least in one other collaboration that was published for balancing single photons of making energy.
That's quite possible. I would have to look at that. But in any case, if that is the case, then for the gauge masses of order TV.
In fact, it's just the old way that people thought we would do neutrino masses. Before and left turned on, people didn't realize that the line shape would be such a great thing. And they talked about the neutrino counting, which is looking at the...
Okay, so you're saying you know for sure that if the neutralinos are less than 80 GeV, then it's ruled out.
I don't know
whether they decay or not.
Some number might.
Okay, so then that would mean that you would have to push up the correspondence by a factor of 2, I guess, or not 2, but by a factor of 1.5. You would have to push this up. So then that would mean that the gauge in the masses cannot be less than 1.5 GeV. Okay, so but if you don't like that, then it's ruled out. So, in any case, but as far as the production cross section, that's the numbers that I know. These are the latest numbers that we have obtained. Mm-hmm. That does not seem to be ruled out. Well, unless they decay predominantly into the leptons instead of the B quarks. So, So the point of this bottom line here was that the upcoming LEP2 data is supposed to come down to this number here, and then it's supposed to be doing better than that. So since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to discuss many issues which arise in TV scale quantum gravity. In particular, you would have to discuss them in this as well. But,
would you comment on the proton stability? Because I think.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to comment on that, but I'm not going to discuss those guys.
Okay.
I'll probably touch upon the neutrino masses in a moment. But, okay, so as far as the proton stability is concerned, the easiest thing to do would be to, say, gauge baryon number, right? But with three generations, you cannot gauge a baryon number that easily because it's anomalous. You know. With four generations, it's actually basically trivial to gauge a baryon number because you can cancel the anomalies. And a particular charge assignment that you have to write down is that the first three generations have the usual baryon number assignment. Well, actually, this is like three times the usual baryon. It's a matter of normalization. Whereas the fourth generation has opposite and three times larger than the first three generations. And then this is anomaly free. The way to see this in a simple way is that if I look at this index A as an SU3 global index, so it's a triplet of SU3, then this is a decomposition of a 4 of SU4. So, if I gauge U1B, say in the bulk, where the extra dimensions live, so that the gauge coupling of the U1 is very small and it's harmless, and then I can give it a mass of inverse millimeter or higher, so I don't see the fifth course, then or at least it's not ruled out by the current experiment, then that would forbid the proton decay, because you know, it's a conserved quantity. Of course, it's broken at the end of the day, so it has a mass. But then the suppression in the coupling is going to be of order of m Planck fundamental over m Planck four dimensional squared, which is precisely the kind of suppression you're looking for a bit to suppress proton decay. However, you can actually kill the proton decay altogether if you want to. I mean, just gauge a Z2 subgroup of this, okay? Then the operators that mediate proton decay always have QQQ in them, and then a bunch of some other stuff, say L. But then that QQQ has charge plus 3, which in this case, which is concerned mod Z2, would be plus 1, and therefore that kind of operator would be forbidden. So Z2 subgroup of this would kill all delta B equals 1 operators. Now, you would have to actually worry about delta B equals 2 operators. If you want to kill delta B equals 2 operators instead of gauging Z2, you could gauge Z4. And then Z4 would kill both delta B equals 1 and delta B equals 2 operators. You could do that. Now, in an exactly similar fashion, you can gauge the lepton number. Instead of Q here, you would have L. Instead of B here, you would have E. And instead of U, you would have N, where N is the right-handed neutrino superfield. And then if you do that, the reason why it's desirable to do that is because you have these operators, LA, LB, L4 star squared. These are dimension 5 operators. And when L4 gets a VEV, these operators will induce neutrino masses, the Majorana masses, for the first 3 generation neutrinos, which are of order 10 GeV, because it's going to be the exact same thing. M electroweak squared divided by M Planck fundamental, which is of order 10 GeV. So you want to kill these operators. And the Z3 symmetry, which I would obtain from gauging, actually let me write this down because it's kind of hard to see. So I have L, E, N, and for first 3 generations, I have plus 1, minus 1, minus 1. And for the 4th generation, I have minus 3, plus 3, plus 3. This would be gauging lepton U1. Okay. But now I can consider, say, a Z3 subgroup of this, where everything is concerned mod 3. And then these guys would remain the same, and these guys would be 0, because it's mod 3, and it's anomaly free, this discrete subgroup. So then I'll kill all these operators. Okay. And these operators you have to kill in PV scale quantum gravity, because otherwise you have these 10 GeV neutrinos floating around. At the same time, you can see from here that the mixing between the first 3 and the 4th generation with the Z3 discrete symmetry is automatically killed, unless Z3 is broken. Okay, if Z3 exists and the 4th generation neutrino, fourth generation leptons don't mix with the first 3 generation leptons, and therefore you avoid the problems with the, say, lepton non-universality or whatnot. So all I have to do is see what Scott is talking about and see whether the scenario could be ruled out a little bit more easily than one might have suspected originally. So I guess I'm going to stop here. Well, even that doesn't have to be
the other generations. It looks differently. The matter is light and all other junk that you don't need to scale. But why, since originally, before all breaking, you have just 4 sequential generators, why it happened so that it, I mean, is there any reason why it should be 3-to-1? Why not 2-to-2, say? 2 generations look like...
Well, I just gave you discrete symmetry that segregated the third one from the first. The world could be arranged in such a way that there's this discrete D3 symmetry.
Okay, you say, okay, I have this extra construction, gain this or whatever, but then you break this fourth generation cylinder by hand, essentially, right?
No, no. I mean, you don't break it by hand. I mean, that discrete symmetry is part of the model, then that's part of the model, right? Then the first three and the fourth one are not on equal footing because of the discrete symmetry. But it's not fine-tuning, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not saying this is pretty or...
Well, you can't fine-tune with integers, I guess.
Yeah, I know.
That's true.
Well, there is a notion of discrete fine-tuning sometimes, you know.
Well, maybe.
Actually, by the way, wait a second. Let me point out that, as far as the neutralinos are concerned, the mass of the neutralinos, okay, I generated that mass of 65 GeV or whatever via the CISO mechanism, okay. Now, that, and I assume that was a predominant contribution to the neutralino, to the corresponding neutralino mass. Of course, I didn't have to, okay, I could write down the source for it, because I have to say, in this scenario, I'll have the fourth generation neutrino, okay, the fourth generation right-handed neutrino, and I could just write down another 15 GeV for that, I could get another 15 GeV from there, okay? So, the key here is that the mass of the neutralino is not very important, okay? What is important is that you have this fourth generation neutrino, and you can pair produce. You can produce it in ZDK, and then you can have some product of decay. And that cross section poses a non-trivial bound as far as the this whole scenario is concerned. And you know, if you measure that cross section, it comes out at the at lab 2 data, which has not been analyzed yet. If it comes out of say 0.25. picobarns, then that's it. That's the end of the day. However, what Scott was pointing out, that just the mass constraint I can avoid easily, because I just can add another 15 to 20 GeV to my neutralina from another source if I don't want it to be coming from the CISO alone. So that's not so. In a way, when I was saying, oh, maybe it's ruled out, that was too fast, because the scenario where the neutralino would come predominantly from the neutralino mass would come predominantly from the CISO matrix, and the gauginos would be less than TV, that would be ruled out by data that he was pointing out. However, I can push the mass, but the neutralino cross section, I don't think it's affected very much by another 15 GeV. It would not be affected. And so, but that would be a real test of this kind of a scenario. It's just the cross sections that matter. Okay, we have to check the cross section. And the lab 2 data, once it's analyzed, it will give you those cross sections. So it's going to be either larger or smaller, and then one can see whether it's really ruled out or not. Yeah, well, if you can show that there is no way to mimic these guys with higher dimensional operators, then, then actually you would prove a very strong statement. But that's possible. I mean, yeah, that would be. Then you would kill it right away. You know, they don't have to wait even for 2 years. Nothing to say about LHC. Here I was trying to say, wait for LHC, you know, maybe let's teach us something new, you know. And he's saying, oh, we don't have to wait for anything. We can just do it on a piece of paper, you know. Okay, maybe.